man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Welcome to Who Shot Ya? What's up, everybody? It's your host, Iffy Whiteyway, holding it down back in the virtual booth with my friends, keeping it live and direct on the Maximum Fun Network. It's going to be fun. But first, let's introduce those folks in the booth. First off and foremost, Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Well, Iffy, I'll tell you what's good is the air quality over Los Angeles. And I'm sure this is probably something that's happening globally where suddenly it turns out if you don't pack the street with a bunch of combustion engines every day, like you can see clouds. So that's been exciting. And I also want to give a shout out to my neighborhood of West Hollywood. With a few exceptions, a few scofflaws, for the most part, people seem to be doing a really good job of socially distancing. Streets are empty and quiet, like folks are walking their dogs, but they're doing it at a distance from each other. And, you know, at night, there's just like, it's just so quiet. And, I want to, you see the horror stories, you see the dumb, like, mega churches deciding they're going to be like, I don't care, because Jesus, you know, so I'm really happy that we're taking this seriously.
I just saw an article today. There's some app that's like using anonymous cell phone information, something quickly glossed over, which I was like, hold up. But they're using it to grade cities to see how much people are going out. And Los Angeles County did receive an A on our social distancing practices. So, some of us are, out there listening. It was a rough start at first. People still wanted to ball at Venice Beach, but it seems like now we're starting to get the point. Excellent. Highland Park also doing real good. I've been biking a little bit more, but good job, y'all.
And you're not joking about that air quality. That air quality is real.
That second voice you hear, that chimed up, that wonderful voice we know and love, it's Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
I really just wanted to validate Alonzo. I hear you. It is good. So you guys, my what's good is a bit of a journey, but stick with me. So there is a motion picture called Sunset Boulevard that some of us here are definitely more aware of than others. In said motion picture, it stars, this William Holden is, there's this struggling screenwriter, and then you have this aging movie star goddess who's like losing it a bit. And then she has this very devoted butler played by Eric von Stroheim. And one of the things that's revealed about the butler is that he actually was her first director and her first husband. And now he does all these things that shelter her from the real world and like answers her fan mail and all this stuff. And I give you this context because my what's good is every week, Ingo Kane checks in with me and like sends me one random thing that she just heard on the podcast. And I like to think it's like a personal test that she's proving that she's still listening. But in this week's check-in, she made the funniest comment I've ever heard in my entire life, which was she said that the three of us, me, Alonzo, and Iffy, are all Gloria Swanson, and Casey is our butler husband. And that made me laugh for like 20 hours straight. And that is what's good with me.
All right. I'm trying to, that seemed great. Ingu never hits me up. So ask her about that next time she checks in. Ask her. I guess she'll find out because she's listening.
Clearly.
But yeah, we have a wonderful, stunning TV editor at IndieWire, Kristen Lopez. What's good?
I wish I could say my neighborhood, but unfortunately, the fine folks of Toluca Lake don't seem to care about what's going on in the world because I have been taking walks with a lot of people on the sidewalk who do not seem to give the road when you are walking toward them. And I almost punched a guy in the face for yawning without covering his mouth. Does that? In these times, who does that? So Toluca Lake needs to shape up because y'all suck right now. But in terms of what's good for me, I just watched 9 episodes of Mrs. America on FX on Hulu. And it's not out yet, but it's really awesome. And I will be talking about it ad nauseum for the next 6 months-ish. So getting in early by announcing it here that it's awesome, and I'm super happy about it.
Ooh. Oh, counting the days. Iffy, what's good?
Oh, man, what's good with me is, oh, man, you know, when Alonzo is right, Alonzo is right, okay? I've been getting all the Blu-rays I've ordered. I got my new Blu-ray rack, which, you know, would honestly my uncles of yesteryear would scoff at because it's not as tall as some of the VHS racks I've ever seen. The thing I don't think I ever talked about what initially pushed me to do it was there was this anime I liked called The Big O, but I was trying to watch it because it was one of my favorite anime growing up, and nowhere was streaming it. Netflix didn't have it. Hulu didn't have it. Amazon didn't have it. So I had to go on eBay and spend like $80 for the Steelbook box set of the complete series. But That's what made me come. I came to my senses. I was like, Alonzo's right. These streaming sites, they're not always going to be here for us, and you got to own it.
Has anybody else been noticing that because you're, you know, especially those of us who live in apartments and are surrounded by other people doing the same thing, that streaming between like 7 p.m. and 11 p.m. is next to impossible now?
Oh, because yeah.
Everybody's at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been chopping right up. All right, so today's show is going to be really fun, really great. We're going to be talking about the movie Crip Camp, and we're going to take a call from the Who Shot line, and of course, we'll have our staff picks. But first, we have a new segment on our show with movie production halted and movie release dates getting pushed back. Our news sources for our It Addicts segment have run dry. So while we're all social distancing and recording remotely, we're introducing a brand new segment that I think you all will enjoy. This is your movie life, the grade school years. But in the coming weeks, we're going to take a voyage through our lives to discuss the films that shaped who we are today, the movies we love, the movies that inspired us, the movies that influenced our fashion choices. Movies have always had a huge impact on who we are, and we will explore those films right now. This week, we're going back to the beginning and discussing our grade school years. This is from first to fifth grade in our new segment, This Is Your Movie Life. Drea, would you please begin?
It would be my honor. Also, I'm going to preface my choice by saying this film came out a decade before my grade school years because I am very young and very, like, I love that we're making fun of Iffy for being a baby when he's a grown man with a child. But, so when in thinking about this, and I know that we're going to do these kind of divided into grade school and middle school or junior high, whatever. And so trying to think of something that I connected with or that made a really big impact on me, the movie that immediately came to mind was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And
ooh,
that movie, so it's one of my first movie memories because they showed it in school when I was like, I don't know, second or third grade maybe. And it must have been like a rainy day or a snow day, whatever it was. One of those days they kind of gather everybody and they watch the film. And it was the first time I'd seen it. And when I got home, my memory isn't of me watching the film for the first time. My memory is that when I got home and then my mother got home from work, I very clearly remember following her room to room as she like changed out of her work clothes and started making dinner or whatever. And I just was talking through scene by scene of this movie that I had seen. And she was, I don't know if she probably hadn't seen it or maybe she had, but either way, she just let me babble as many people do. And I was so excited and it had all of these fantasy elements and super imaginative, but also recognizable bits. Like I recognize those kids, even in their, you know, very broad stroke examples of horribleness. And just everything, the world building of it and the fantasy of it. And I wanted to talk about it. And I think it's such a strong memory for me, not just because of the very hilarious visual of me pestering my poor mother for however long, but the idea of movies to me have since then been this kind of confluence of a story and a world that's really exciting. But then also there's a social element. There's the discussion of it, of, oh, and then they did this. And what do you think the Oompa Loompas are? And isn't this girl terrible? Do you think she deserved to be turned into a blueberry? Like, I don't know. It stands to me. So, yeah. So it was the combination of those things, like in looking at this series and talking about movies that are like truly ingrained in us. Like, that is such a strong sense memory. And then it's also a film, you know, I think a lot of kids love that film, that it's dark and weird in a way that kids are attracted to, and not a lot of kids' stories take advantage of. And although many do.
Oh, Drea, I think I'm learning so much about why we're such good friends, because this is also one of my very first movie memories. The difference, of course, being that I saw it in the original run, but well, yeah, I was 4 years old. My oldest sister and her high school boyfriend took me to see it, and yeah, it made a very strong impression on me. And then it's the kind of movie that would pop up on TV like every Thanksgiving or whatever. And so like it was sort of ingrained in me as a kid, and then I kind of forgot about it. And then it's a movie that we all sort of rediscovered in college, and we were like, oh my God, this movie is so much more twisted than we maybe even understood as children, you know? And I became re-obsessed with it in my like late teens, and still am to this day. Like the home screen of my cell phone is a Wonka bar.
This
is a movie that totally sunk its claws into me. And funnily enough, years later, when I worked for the old Movie Line magazine, my editor was Ed Margulies, whose father, Stan Margulies, was one of the executive producers. And we were having lunch one time, and he asked what my earliest movie memory was. I said, well, weirdly enough, it was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And he looked at me for a beat and he said, oh, you never had a chance.
I love that.
No. I was just going to say, for me, yeah, this was one that I revisited later. And it's so interesting, and we'll get into this more when we talk about my movie and media experience, because like it's interesting, because I don't want to like play it like my dad didn't understand American media, but just he had a different taste, where things like the whimsy, he didn't really get into whimsy until late in his life. You know, he's really into Nollywood. So it kind of depended on my mom, and my mom really went the traditional route, but I don't think she was watching Willy Wonka as well. So Willy Wonka came to me through like TV reruns, which is something I do think about now, because so much of, I think, the younger generation being exposed to older pieces of media is kind of flipping through channels and being like, oh, what's this, you know, and leaving it on, and that's kind of gone.
True. Yeah, you don't stumble upon things anymore.
Well, the only thing that plays anymore is every time I turn the TV on, a Harry Potter movie is on, which I don't hate. But minimal discovery if the same 7 films are in rotation.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I remember watching Willy Wonka from a very early age, but it never really became a thing to me until, like Alonzo, until I got older. And then I realized just how problematic it was, and like, how are the Oompa Loompas? Are they union workers? You know, like, who's paying them? Those were the things that I thought about. But it wasn't... If anything, I think watching Wizard of Oz and Willy Wonka is fascinating, because much like the Oompa Loompas, you know, you wonder about how like the economy of the Emerald City works out. But it was always interesting that I remember watching that movie a lot, but it never really resonated for me until I was, I think, old enough to appreciate it.
So what would you qualify then as sort of your, or one of your like early movies that stuck with
you?
Oh
my gosh. Okay. So I'm happy my mom's not here, because if she was, she'd know exactly what my answer is. So I was what we call an incredibly mature child, in the sense that I knew movies were fictional, and yet at the same time, I took them to heart really easily. And Drea might know what I'm going to say, because I've probably brought this up several times. So the movie that I, if we're talking about the film, the patient zero of what made me the person that I am today, it's My Girl. I can chart every single element of my life back to that movie, from like the fact that I'm a hypochondriac, the fact that my best friend was a boy who thankfully did not die. You know, the fact that I became an English major, the fact that I have a really, really unsettling love for Griffin Dunne. It all goes back to being like that first grade kid. My mom will tell you she let me watch it because she thought it was just a fun kids film about, you know, like summer fun and a young girl coming of age. And my mom's like, if I had known what the content of that movie was and how depressing and weird and how much that would become who you were, she's like, I wouldn't have let you watch it. But I love it. It's everything that I love about myself is probably something I stole from Anna Chomsky in 1991. So that's the movie that, yeah, if you're talking about the film from like first grade on, that nobody ever saw, so I was like the only outlier that was like, hey, we should all watch My Girl. And then I'd have my second grade friends over, and they're like, the minute it starts in a funeral home, they're like, this is a happy film, right? I'm like, oh yeah, it's great. It's great. I mean, it's not happy. Nothing really positive happens until the very, very end. But you know, it's great. I was that kid that just traumatized the neighborhood. But at the same time, you know, it's who I am today. So thank you, director who I totally forgot directed that movie, who I know is no longer with us. But yeah, the reason I am who I am today is all because of My Girl. It's that movie's fault.
If kids weren't watching that, how would they know to be afraid of bees? Like, were they just watching?
Right? I know.
Were they just watching Wicker Man really young instead?
So, Iffy, in the bell jar of your childhood, what movies were you exposed to?
Oh man, that's what I was really going to, because there's so many ways to kind of approach this, but I think I'm gonna go with the kind of my first movie that I've owned, that I the theater experience I remembered, because my dad took me down to El Capitan to see this, and it was a fun experience. But it was The Lion King, classic, the animated one, not the CG. but yeah, that was that.
No, that
was a film
that
I remember. But I remember like my, like getting the VHS and them being like, this is yours. This was like, it's my memory of like the first piece of film that I owned as well. And so it was my duty to watch it as many times as I could, because it was mine. And seeing it in El Capitan was great, because you know, before the show, they sometimes, it depends on the movie you go to see, they still kind of do it, but they'll have characters come out and sing a song either from the film that you're about to watch, or sing a song that has to do with Disney in some way or another. And this one they did, they were singing I Just Can't Wait to Be King, and they had like giraffes and stuff popping out, and I thought it was so cool, and I was able to sing along. You know, this is so Lion King sticks with me in that way, that I just remember it not being able to beat the video game because it was unnecessarily difficult, but also just kind of like taking it in and just seeing this beautiful story that was stolen.
I think the Lion King VHS is such a millennial touchstone, because I know so many people in the neighborhood of your age, and that's the movie they talk about just watching over and over and over again because they owned it.
Yeah, there were two movies I watched over and over. It was The Lion King and Moonwalker. So
The Lion King is such a juggernaut. I remember being in my early grade school years as well. And that was like, I remember so many bad home performances with me and my friends of various songs from this movie. And you know, it's such a bright and colorful film. It's a beautiful example of Disney's animation at that time. Like,
oh, yeah.
For anybody that grew up in the early 90s, I don't think you could be untouched by The Lion King and its largesse at that time.
Yeah, no, totally. It was, and it was the, you know, when they, there was that era of VHS when they had the like squishy plasticky, yes, the clamshell boxes. And that's one thing I do remember is it had the clamshell box and not the sleeve. And I just remember loving the like squeeze it together. Even though
I think I have mine still somewhere. I don't know where it went with when we moved, but I remember having all of my big clamshell boxes. My mom used to say that one day they would be what I'd retire on, and I had to break her heart and tell her, no, they're worth nothing now. But I know it's somewhere in my garage.
Oh, yeah.
Because I grew up in the era when the Disney movies would get reissued on the 7-year cycle, you know? So there was like once or twice a year, there was always some vintage Disney title popping up. This was back when it was still when Song of the South was part of that rotation. But then I remember like when my first nephew was born in the early 80s, then suddenly having like this collection of like Dumbo and Alice in Wonderland and Robin Hood and all these movies. And it was just like, it felt so, you know, modern, you know, that he wasn't gonna have to wait and see these in the theater. They were all just going to be at his fingertips.
Yep. Changing the game. But, you know, I feel like that's the amount of time that we have for our This Is Your Movie Life. It was good dipping into all our lives and seeing where they connected. You know, I'm glad I eventually landed on Lion King because my initial one was going to be Mortal Kombat because that was a experience that stuck out to me 1 year after Lion King at that. So
I will say ABC reran On a Clear Day You Can See Forever a lot in the mid-70s, and that's why I'm gay.
Yep. Well, with that, I think we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back after we hear from another show for Maximum Fun.
Hi, I'm Dave Hill from before, and I'm very excited to bring Dave Hill's Podcasting Incident back to Maximum Fun, where it belongs. You can get brand new episodes every Friday on MaximumFun.org, or, you know, wherever. And while my partner Chris Gersbeck and I might lack in specific subject matter on our podcast, we make up for in special effects. Chris, add something cool right here. Also, we have explosions, animal noises, and sometimes even this. Dave Hill's Podcasting Incident, every Friday on Maximum Fun. Chris, do another explosion right here.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the virtual booth with me are...
Drea Clark.
Kristen Lopez.
Alonzo Duralde.
And today we're talking about the new Netflix documentary, Crip Camp. Kristen, would you mind providing us with a synopsis?
Sure. Crip Camp is a documentary directed by Jim LeBrecq and Nicole Newham, and it tells the story of a group of disabled teenagers who attended a camp in the Catskills called Camp Jened in the 70s, and several of them would go on to create the disabled rights movement that would eventually lead several years down the line to the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Ooh, yes, yes. Alonzo had a great question to kind of start this off, so I'm going to just hand the virtual mic over to him to ask said question.
Well, sure, yeah. You know, I love this movie, just a spoiler, and this was really a story I didn't know at all, and I know that, you know, as I feel like I'm on top of, for example, you know, when it's a documentary about the queer civil rights movement or about the, you know, AIDS activism movement, that I know a lot of that stuff. And then I'll see it at a film festival and somebody in their early 20s will get up and be like, you know what? I never heard any of this before. And so with Crip Camp, I'm the I never heard any of this before guy. But so I was curious from Kristen's point of view, how well known is this specific story and these specific activists within the disabled community?
Yeah. So, I mean, for people who don't know me specifically, I am a physically disabled writer who writes a lot about representation and disability in media. And as somebody who has grown up in a wheelchair for 30 some odd years, I did not know anything about this story before I watched this documentary. I knew that there had been a disability rights movement, quote unquote, but I had just never really heard the specifics of it and what that looked like and what they had achieved. I think before this, the closest I'd come was the episode of Drunk History that they did on this, which is also very fun if you want an alternative kind of highlights Cliff Notes version of it. That episode does a lot of the basics. But I didn't know at all how that had started, let alone that it had involved a camp in the mountains, you know, that catered to disabled individuals. And I left this documentary, I think, more than anything, feeling really irritated, because as a child who grew up, you know, we talked about movies that made us. I grew up on a lot of summer camp films, and I couldn't go to summer camp because there was a question of liability. And, you know, what happens if I'm away from my family for that long and something, I was to get hurt, you know, so I never got to go. And most of the camps that were catering to people with disabilities were either very far away. And for me, as somebody who was growing up surrounded by able-bodied people, there was always the stigma of it being very simplistic, you know, like that it was catering towards people more with developmental disabilities. So it was going to be a lot of children's things and stuff that was just not really of my interest. And so watching this documentary more than anything showed me that, you know, my own biases and my own privileged thinking about how that looks, because the camp segments per se are very insightful in terms of how being a disabled teenager has not changed at all since the 1970s. It's just a bit more open.
I think one important element that if you haven't yet seen Crip Camp, that's key to understanding is just how horny these kids are.
And, yes.
And
yes.
I think, you know, when we're describing it, because of how culturally it's typically been portrayed and because of what's already cooked into our heads, I think when you say, like, oh, it's a documentary about a collection of teenagers with a wide variety of disabilities all at one camp, and you picture, like, kind of what Kristen was assuming of, a lot of, like, just a separation and, you know, putting them into groups. This was the confluence with hippie culture when Camp Jened was in full swing, and then their access, the amount of archival footage they have from the camp. And I think the perfect example of the free-for-all spirit of Camp Jened and the fact that these teenagers got to live, like, probably fuller lives, and they say it too, than they had been permitted to till that point, is there is this enormous outbreak of crabs that took place. And yeah. they're all hooking up like teenagers at camp do, and it spreads not even like wildfire, it spreads like crabs. And they separate the boys and the girls for a whole day, and there is something very funny, like, that there's almost a joy in the fact that they're like, yeah, we even get STDs. And I found this film exuberant and illuminating in ways that were so raunchy and visceral, rather than like that kind of soft lit inspirational. And that's both at the footage from the camp is fun and crunchy that way. And that goes through their activism as well, of like, it's even when there are moments of, like, you know, powerful speeches or emotional pleas, it's never sanitized. It's never cleaned up in this way that we generally get things.
That was exactly what I was going to say. And what I like, you know, is that I think we often sleep on how not sterilizing these stories can do so much more, because first off and foremost, when I was first introduced to Crip Camp, it was like the picture of the camp, and I thought it would only focus on the camp. I didn't know it was this amazing story that leads all the way to the activism. But even more so, I think, you know, a lot of people might look at just kind of like the kind of picture of the camp that's kind of being used on Netflix and think that it's going to be this, like, you know, yeah, this inspirational, just like you said, soft lit, inspirational, sad music gets you in the feels, but really it's like a really fun documentary. And it really, and I like, of course, that was what I was going to talk about, is the horniness of it all. But there was something that like really stood out to me, which was the later parts of the activism. And when I forget her name, but she had the appendicitis that was unnecessary. And she was mentioning how the doctor didn't even consider that she could have had gonorrhea. But it's almost similar to just like the same way people of color are often desexualized. And I think, you know, even on a grander scale, you know, differently abled folks are kind of looked at in this way of like, oh, Santina Mua, who is a UCB performer and good friend of mine, and she's, you know, been in a wheelchair most of her life, and she did this great one woman show, and like one of the segments was a whole song dedicated to a question she often gets asked, which is, how do you have sex? And like, she, one of the lines that always cracks me up is, she was like, I didn't know that people who walk have sex standing up, you know, like it, and it's so true that people just, if you change anything about a person, people just assume that they just don't have the same wants, needs. And I think it's because oftentimes they will be portrayed in this, like, they're like, oh, we don't want to show them too horny, you know, we, because of this, that, or third.
There's still this infantilization of it.
Yes.
The lack of media doesn't help. I've written about this a couple of times, you know, that disability is presented through the lens of a straight white male who is usually disabled late in life. So you have that able-bodied buffer of being like, they're just like us, and watch them get struck down in their prime. And when it comes to sexuality, that usually is only reserved for storylines about married men. You know, if you look at like Eddie Redmayne in The Theory of Everything.
Yeah.
You know, women, disabled women, when they do show up, which is very rare, are not sexual beings at all, you know? And if they are, it's usually because they have some sort of facial scarring or something, you know, it's a physical, how will a man love me if my face is messed up, you know, let alone if I'm disabled, you know, in a wheelchair. And so I think that's what Crip Camp really does so well. And when I've been fortunate to talk to Jim LeBrecq and Nicole Newham, and they said that the movie was already a hard sell, but they wanted to sell it as a summer camp movie because that's a universal trope of being a teenager. And I think that that's something so valid because the landscape with disabled representation in media is still older people. You know, you don't see disabled teenagers or disabled children unless they're like pawns meant to die to like galvanize an able-bodied hero in some way. So I think this movie does a lot towards saying that there's a whole world of experience that media is not being able to showcase. So if you're a disabled teen, you know, how do you find what's normal if you're not represented in a movie, if you don't have something? You know, I can tell you, I never felt seen in films to the extent of being a disabled person. I felt seen as being a woman, being a white, you know, woman, but not as a disabled woman. That just never factored in.
One of the things that I love about movies in general, particularly when they are made by communities that I'm not a part of or aimed at communities I'm not a part of, is I get to feel like I am listening in on the conversations that are never happening when I'm in the room. So I loved moments like the woman talking about the doctor just assuming that it couldn't be, you know, an STD. The part where there's the couple who both have cerebral palsy, and the guy says that his mother wonders why he couldn't find the nice polio, and how like there's the hierarchy where the polio are on top and, you know, moving down to the cerebral palsy people. Like, I had no idea that that was a thing, and now I do. And I love being privy to tidbits like that are so vital and just, you know, kind of, I don't want to say humanizing because that sounds condescending, but just, it's just this interesting stuff that otherwise I wouldn't know about. And now I know it.
Well, and that's important. I think that what Crip Camp does so well is, you know, I've told this story to, and I think Dre has heard this story, that for me, the movie that scared the crap out of me so much as a child was Pet Sematary, was Zelda in Pet Sematary, because as somebody who grew up not seeing a disabled person, I figured that was going to be me one day, that we all were going to end up looking like these grotesque things. And what Crip Camp does is it puts so many people with different disabilities, many of which, unfortunately, in our day and age, there's still that stigma of it's upsetting. It's something, you know, you don't want to see a person with severe cerebral palsy who is, you know, nonverbal. You know, there's something that's still kind of like taboo or about it. And what this movie does so expertly is say that, like, yes, these people look physically striking to you, but, you know, that really limits you from knowing who they are. That round table sequence where they're talking about their parents and how their parents don't understand them, even though they've sent them to camp. You know, that's a very real moment for me as somebody who's kind of talked to her own parents about saying, like, you know, you limited me in this way because there's just that inherent ableism in your brain. It's not a bad thing, but it's just, it exists. And I think that's what the movie does, is say, you know, show whose disabled story is valid. Well, it should all be valid, but even in the disabled community, there's still this hierarchy of who can pass for as able as you can. And it's something that I still, you know, we still talk about today. I know, like, with regards to, like, parking spaces, you know, if somebody jumps out and they're able to walk, I'm always kind of like, yeah, but, you know, it's not a wheelchair there. You know, it's a different set of I mean, even I fall into that whole, like, hierarchy thing of, like, who's more disabled. But it's important because depending on where you fall on that hierarchy, your story becomes more or less valid.
I think the other element of the hierarchy that was fascinating to me, in blending from, you know, we start at this camp, this wild, lawless, hippie camp, and then it moves and showcases how the thinking of this camp affected them and their transition into activism, into making not just culture, well, both legislative and cultural change for Americans with disabilities. And the idea of watching, you know, because there's early footage of Jim Lebrecht, who's one of the directors and one of the primary subjects we're following. So we see him at this camp and he has spina bifida. He's in a chair. And there's a moment, you know, I think it might even be the same round table, when one of the almost nonverbal women with cerebral palsy is trying to say something. And he's told to talk to her and he speaks to her in third person. And like a counselor or someone gently says, like, she's here, you know, don't tell me what you think of her, you can tell her. And so I loved that this film managed to represent this community both as a wide collection of individuals with very different and specific challenges or strengths, and also as a monolith, that how they made change was they embraced all of those differences. They acknowledged all of them. They looked at the wide range of, you know, because you had everything from deaf activists to they showed them, they did this big sleep in at City Hall in San Francisco, and just the range of things, because they had to present as a monolith to make the kind of change within the structure of government that they had. And I felt too, like, again, in terms of lessons learned, for me it was much more, oh yes, there are plenty of things I want to change right now. Sign me up for a monolith with plenty of people that have plenty of differences for me, as long as we got that one thing.
I like how savvy that Judy Heumann and a lot of the other activists are in terms of knowing that people are so willing to kind of literally overlook them and not want to deal with them in a face-to-face way, how they use that in their activism. Like, all right, fine, we're going to roll 20 wheelchairs into the street and block traffic, and, you know, you're going to notice us, you're going to see us. And it's like they're taking the fact that so often, you know, abled society wants to just kind of, like, you know, pretend you're invisible, and sort of using that as a factor in getting noticed and being seen. I thought that was really shrewd.
I think with regards to the activism, Judy Heumann is like my new icon. Us short brunettes, we're loud and we can get stuff done. But I think what this movie does it, you know, Larry Allison, the creator of Camp Jeanette, says it, that it's up to the able-bodied people at this point to kind of take the reins. And as somebody who's had so many conversations with, you know, friends who have said, you know, you're too abrasive, you're asking for too many things, you're being difficult in the things that you're asking for. I mean, Judy Human says it at one point, if I have to feel grateful every time they create a disabled bathroom, how are we ever going to be equal? And that's really, I think, what this documentary does so well, especially now. You know, I watched this before we all became quarantined, and it's even more important now because so much of what we ask for is perceived as an entitlement. It's perceived as we're not working hard enough, that we want too much. And, you know, in a landscape now where I've talked to so many disabled people who are frustrated at seeing, you know, Zoom conferencing becoming a thing, or like other things yeah. that they've asked for so many years just to live their life. And now, you know, when everybody else wants it, you know, now it's something we can implement. And I think that that's what this documentary really says, is that the 1970s, they were asking just to be able to go into a business. But at the same time, what they opened the door for hasn't really been changed since, you know, that time. I mean, there's still issues of accessibility. There's so many massive loopholes in the ADA with regards to accessible housing. The Social Security system is a nightmare. You know, they're
yeah.
that the conversations that they started in the 70s were just the beginning. And the sad fact is that there's not that loud voice anymore, that interest. We're still being perceived as having to be grateful that there's one handicap bathroom, you know, in your place of business.
Can we vote on this film? I love this film.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So obviously, we're going to mix it up. Our final review will be stream it over Google Hangouts, stream it by yourself, or skip it. Yeah, we'll let you take the lead, Alonzo.
Oh, okay. Yep. Stream it over Google Hangouts. Share it with people. Get folks to watch this movie. It is, I think, you know, of all the things that make it so timely for right now, it is, among other things, a reminder that the government is capable of doing so much good for so many people. But if you are one of those people who is not like a white, heterosexual, Christian, able-bodied, cisgendered, you know, a wealthy man, you have to grab them by the ankles and shake them and shake them and shake them and shake them until they finally make it happen. So I am so empowered by the activists in this movie. And I'm so glad I know this story now. And I think it's just a great film. People should see it.
I'll follow up on that. I also agree that this is a stream it over Google Hangouts, because we're very modern. This was one of my favorites from Sundance that you might remember from my wrap up oh so long ago. And I've been encouraging people to see it ever since. It's a great view. And it also was one of those wonderful movie moments similar to Hidden Figures, where I watched it and was like, how do I not know about this woman, Judy Human? So there's so much to enjoy and get psyched about in this without feeling like treacly or pandered to.
Yeah, I agree as well. It's a stream with friends over Google Hangouts. Mainly if you can, you know, if you are a disabled person, calling up your able-bodied friends and being like, hey, you know all those things I complain about every day? Like, this is what you should see. You know, it's one of those, I hate to say educational, because I feel like disabled people, we educate people all the time. But it's a movie that I think educates and entertains in equal measure. So it's a vital piece of cinema, especially in these times as we're all in the same boat. And hopefully, you know, this will inspire more change for the disabled and not going back to the way things were.
Ooh, yes. And I as well am a stream it over Google Hangouts. And yeah, just getting folks to pay up and pay attention, but also pay up. If they have money, pay up, but pay attention to what's really going on. And if, you know, before we go to break, I just wanted to, cause this crossed my mind, and just, if you don't have nothing right off the cuff, Kristen, I was wondering, because you made a good point about good, disabled representation, and like the closest thing I can personally think of was Walt Jr. in Breaking Bad. And I was like, that might not even be that dope. If you had like maybe a piece of media that has like good representation, you find.
Yeah, the one I always go to is Speechless, the ABC series that they canceled. Hopefully you can find it streaming somewhere. It's the first time I can tell you that I felt represented. It came out a couple years ago, and it's a lower class family dealing with the pratfalls of both typical, you know, kid hijinks, as well as the issues of housing and social security and jobs and, you know, independence. So it's definitely my go-to. If you want something classic, go for The Best Years of Our Lives from 1946. That's also a really great movie that does, that did its homework at the time in terms of accepting people with disabilities. Both are not perfect, still white guys, but they are better than the numerous other options out there.
And I believe Speechless is on Hulu.
Ooh.
Yay! Well, watch that after.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun. You sit right there.
Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hello, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is Wonderful.
It's a podcast that we do as we are married. And how's the ad going so far? Because I think it's going very good.
We talk about things we like every week on Wednesdays.
One time Rachel talked about pumpernickel bread. It was so tight. You cannot afford to miss her talking about this sweet brown bread.
We also talk about music and poems and, you know, weather.
There was one...
Weather?
One time Rachel talked about Baby Beluga, this song, for like 14 minutes. And it just really blew my hair back.
So check us out on MaximumFun.org.
It's a cool podcast with chill vibes. Amber is the color of our energy, is what all the iTunes reviews say.
They will now.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the virtual booth with me are...
Alonzo Duralde.
Kristen Lopez.
Drea Clark.
And now we're jumping to the staff picks. Kristen, why don't you start?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so there were a lot of movies I could have picked. I could have said Knives Out for the umpteenth time, because that's usually my go-to at the moment. But I'm gonna try to go for something that I watched on Disney Plus the other day. I needed a comfort movie because I was having a lot of anxiety about our current sitch. So I decided to revisit an old friend, which is 1986's The Great Mouse Detective. It is a joyous movie that has aged remarkably well, and I'm still very upset that Disney did not turn this into a multi-million dollar franchise. I cry for the day that they decide to do a live action, quote unquote, remake of this. I hope that never happens, but I would put nothing past The House of Mouse. But it's a great kids movie that blends Sherlock Holmes with you know, modern day whodunits, and it's such a great movie with some really interesting context that I never realized how Radigan and Basil of Baker Street are obviously ex-lovers who just hate each other so much, but they also love each other so much. I will never not believe that theory. So it's genius, and the animation is still really great, especially if you watch it on Disney Plus. I think it looks like it's been restored because it really pops on screen. So if you have Disney Plus and you want to have something that makes you forget the world for 90 minutes, it's perfect.
All right. Do you want to go next, Drea?
Yes. So I will say, before my actual staff pick, for anyone that would like to see what a butler husband in motion looks like, Sunset Boulevard is currently on Amazon Prime. So you can get the full theatrical version of Casey O'Brien in the
future.
And
then go on YouTube and watch the Carol Burnett version.
Yes. So my staff pick is a film that is now coming out on VOD when this comes out. It is called Waves. It was a big festival film this year. It's directed by Trey Edward Schultz, whose last film, It Comes at Night, was a... Relatively, it did pretty well box office. Words are my tools. Oh my God. But it was a great film, in a sort of creepy, dark way. Waves is a family drama, with the, it's a suburban family led by Sterling K. Brown, who's incredible, and I like seeing him utilized in more movies like this. And it primarily concentrates on his two teenage children. And there's also a very interesting storytelling flip. It's almost a diptych that it feels like two films in one. You start off following the son, and then it kind of blends to the daughter after there's, you know, a sort of tragic element in between. So Waves is out, and I think it's a just a really solid American indie drama from the last year that will be VOD as of this weekend.
All right. What about you, Alonzo? What you got for us?
So I know Drea will back me on this, but you know, when you do festivals, there are certain people that you get to know and certain names you start looking for in the credits. And one of the producers of Crip Camp is a guy named Howard Gertler, who has been behind some really interesting documentaries. He was one of the producers of Do I Sound Gay? And one of the producers of a film that I just adore that Crip Camp reminded me a lot of. And that is How to Survive a Plague, the Academy Award nominated documentary about the history of ACT UP and their battles against the U.S. government for treatment to deal with HIV and AIDS. You know, I think that both films have a certain you can fight City Hall quality to them, and they both benefit from kind of the early years of video in terms of, you know, giving us this amazing footage. You know, in Crip Camp, it's the People's Video Project kind of filming the camp itself. But then in How to Survive a Plague, and a lot of these early ACT UP meetings, you had several different people with the big, like, you know, carrying it on their shoulder video cassette recorder and the cameras. So they were able to not just have footage of the meetings, but to like cut angles of the meetings. Anyway, a very inspirational film, a very empowering film. It is streaming on the IFC Films Unlimited app, and it's also for rent in all the places where you can rent. But if you've never seen it, it makes a great double bill with Crip Camp.
I do back you up on that, Alonzo. That's a great okay. film.
My film is kind of a cheat, but you know, it's great for people who listen to what I say about things and go, I want to know, but I don't want to invest as much time as you have. Everyone who has been following me on Twitter knows that Gurren Lagann is one of my favorite anime. It's 26 episodes of pure masterpiece, masterworks, but some people don't have time to invest 26 episodes. Well, some people used to not have time to invest 26 episodes of anime into their life. And lucky for you, there is a trend in Japan that helps you through this, which is where they just smush all of the episodes and make one movie, and then they redo the final battle scenes with new art, and it's phenomenal. So that's why I am recommending both Gurren Lagann parts 1 and 2. And if you watch both parts, you'll have seen the anime. I will say go back and watch it because the smushed up cuts a lot of things. But the final battle sequences for both movies are some of the most beautiful pieces of art that I've got to witness and all types of fun action. And if you're interested in that, definitely check that out.
I'm sure it's in the show notes, but could you spell that title for people who are just listening?
Oh yeah. If you're just listening, it's GurrenLagann. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have anything that you want to plug?
Sure. If you want to find me, I'm on Twitter at @journeys_film. And Drea Clark and I also do a podcast in our free time talking about classic cinema and thirst and all sorts of fun stuff over at Ticklish Business. Wherever you get your podcast, you can probably search for it. We're also on Twitter at Ticklish Biz.
Ooh, that is some good stuff. So check it out. You know you want more Dre in your life. I do. And next week, we'll be discussing Never Rarely, Sometimes Always. So make sure you check that out before we do the episode. You know, you get what I mean. Again, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY 803-1664. Make sure you make it your
Make it your quarantine activity, calling into the Whoosh hotline. And just as a reminder, you can buy a Jumbotron on our show by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. And if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at WhoShotYaPod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYaPodcast, or send us an email at WhoShotYa@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.